bitch.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, John Russell, and Phil Deerking. But first, the Higher Education Report. The coronavirus crisis may have halted classes at many colleges and universities when their campuses closed earlier this year. But that is not the only problem the virus has created for the higher education community worldwide. In addition to study programs, there is other important work taking place at these schools: academic research. Even with some institutions now reopening, their laboratories and the people who work in them may face restrictions on research. Suzanne Ortega is president of the Council of Graduate Schools, a not-for-profit group based in the United States. The council provides support to graduate school education and research projects. Ortega told VOA that just like for everyone else, the sudden, unexpected spread of the coronavirus came as a shock to U.S. academic institutions. Luckily, many schools have been developing crisis communication and risk management plans for years. Some acted quickly, deciding not just to send students home and move classes online. They also decided which research projects to continue and which ones could be delayed. What happened at the institutional level really trickled down to the lab and the departmental level, said Ortega. The government agencies responsible for financing most academic research in the U.S. also announced action. The National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation extended time limits for when researchers need to show the results of their ongoing projects. The NIH and NSF, as the two agencies are known, also advised researchers on what to do in this situation. Some academics even decided to take their animal subjects home to care for them while campus laboratories are closed. Wendy Streitz argues there is no denying that the coronavirus crisis will create barriers for ongoing scientific exploration. She is president of the Council on Government Relations, a group representing 190 research-heavy colleges and universities in the United States. Delays in research can affect study findings, especially when materials must be observed continuously or have limits on their use. And travel restrictions make it unclear when field researchers studying animals or conditions in nature, for example, will get back to work. But as concerns about the effect of the coronavirus on the world economy turn into reality, there is also the financial question, Streitz says. The NIH and NSF are working to ensure that projects stay funded. But in Britain, Cancer Research UK and Macmillan Cancer Support expect to lose hundreds of millions of dollars in donations this year. The two groups are among the country's biggest private fundraisers for cancer research. The research isn't getting done while people are idle. And when people get back to work, there's no guarantee that the government's going to be able to come up with the funds necessary to finish the research. So I think in the long term, we are going to see research projects that can't finish, Streitz noted. Another concern is over what effect this might have on researchers, especially those now taking the first steps in their scientific careers, says Joanne Carney. She is the Chief Government Relations Officer at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Delays in research mean delays in meeting graduation requirements, she says. Also, delays of conferences and large meetings mean the new scientists will miss out on chances to meet others working in their fields. Carney says this might limit the ability of these men and women to advance in their careers. So could decisions by many institutions to temporarily suspend efforts to fill open positions. In fact, Australia's chief scientist has warned that the country's universities may lose as many as 7,000 research positions within the next several months. Travel restrictions have also limited the flow of international students, who represent many of the graduate student researchers in the U.S. and overseas. Yet Carney suggests there may be some good news to come out of this. She says active university laboratories are sharing equipment and their findings like never before. And many researchers who were studying other diseases are now lending their knowledge to the fight against the coronavirus. This scientific knowledge that we are building every single day is going to continue to guide us and contribute to public health for decades to come, said Carney. I'm Pete Musto.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. For many, many years, different cultures and religions around the world have used snakes as symbols. Websites such as History.com and Encyclopedia Britannica tell us about snake symbolism in ancient cultures. They say the image of a snake meant fertility and rebirth for some Native American groups, as well as people living in ancient Greece and Egypt. One ancient symbol of eternity is a snake eating its own tail. This image was found in the burial place of King Tutankhamun, also known as King Tut. He served as Egypt's ruler over 3,300 years ago. A serpent was an important god for ancient Mayans, and the Aztec earth goddess, both creator and destroyer, is represented by a serpent wearing a skirt of snakes. Serpents are also important in both the ancient Norse and Chinese cultures. Encyclopedia Britannica notes that in Baltic traditions, running into a snake was considered good luck, and it was bad luck if you killed one. However, in some religious traditions, a serpent tempted Eve, the world's first woman, to disobey God by eating forbidden fruit. This got her and Adam, the world's first man, expelled from the Garden of Eden. So snakes were important in many cultures. Sometimes they represented creation. At other times, they represented good and evil, and sometimes just evil. Now, as you just heard, sometimes we call snakes serpents. A serpent sounds bigger, more threatening, and even more important than a snake. You can call a serpent a snake when talking about ancient symbols, but it does not work well the other way. If you saw a snake moving on the ground, you would not say, "Hey, look, a serpent just slithered under that rock." We often use the word slither to describe how a snake moves. In the English language, snakes have a bad reputation. A person described as a snake is a liar. He or she acts like a friend to your face, but then does something terrible behind your back. A snake is someone you thought you could trust, but they end up biting you in the end. People who act like your friend, but who want to hurt you instead, are a hidden danger, just like a snake in the grass. Although snakes have a bad reputation, in nature they really want to avoid human contact. Some snakes live in tall grass, often hidden from people and animals. But if you walk too close, one might bite you. So in that way, snakes are dangerous. The same can be said of a person who acts like your friend. And that's the end of this program. Join me again next week for another Words in Their Stories. We leave you with this warning. Be careful. Don't get bit by a snake in the grass. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
An international team of scientists has successfully decoded ancient DNA from animal skin, on which some of the Dead Sea Scrolls were written. The first of the 2,000-year-old religious documents were found in 1947 in a cave near Qumran, about 20 kilometers east of Jerusalem. Scientists since have gathered more than 25,000 pieces of writing on skin and ancient paper in the caves and other sites in the Judean desert. The University of Tel Aviv, the Israeli government, and experts from Uppsala University in Sweden and Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City carried out DNA tests over 7 years. They identified the kind of animal skins used for the documents. The finding will help experts to establish real scrolls from fakes. Many experts believe the scrolls were made by a small Jewish group called the Essenes. The Essenes had separated from the more traditional Jewish religion and were very secretive. However, other experts argue that several people from different groups wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. Those experts believe the scrolls were gathered together and put in the cave to keep them safe during a time of conflict. The DNA tests show that the animal skin used for the writings was mainly from sheep common to the desert area, but there were also some cow skin documents. The scientists say this suggests some documents may have been created in a city like Jerusalem, where cow raising was more common. Jews built a major religious center in the then Roman-ruled city around 2,500 years ago. The biological material of which the scrolls are made is as telling and as informative as the content of the text, said researcher Noam Mizrahi. He is a professor of Bible studies at Tel Aviv University. Study at the DNA laboratory in Uppsala showed the two versions of the document called the Book of Jeremiah were on cow skin. The scientists say the finding shows that these two documents were brought to Qumran from outside. They say the different versions also suggest that the understanding of Jewish religious writings differed. Mizrahi said the Jewish community during the Second Temple appears to have been more diverse in religious understanding than researchers once thought. The team of scientists tested extremely small pieces, even dust, of the scrolls. They say the same process could be used in the future to identify fake scrolls, like those found at the Museum of the Bible in Washington. Museum officials removed the documents in 2018 after discovering they were false. I'm Susan Shand.
Huge bones have been discovered in a place 50 kilometers north of Mexico City, where a new airport is being built. Scientists, who study the past by examining very old objects, are digging up more and more of these bones. These archaeologists have found that the bones belong to the mammoth, the most famous mammal of a cold period in Earth's history, known as an ice age. Archaeologists have found the bones of 70 mammoths so far. The latest discovery includes two large skulls, as well as rib and leg bones. Ruben Manzanilla is the lead archaeologist at the site. Manzanilla said that the place once was part of a shoreline with a lot of mud. Lakes likely formed there at the end of the most recent ice age. When an animal this size fell here, it got stuck and couldn't escape, he said. The mammoth bones belonged to a Colombian mammoth, which, unlike its relative, the woolly mammoth, had little hair. But it was a powerful creature. Manzanilla believes it weighed about 20,000 kilograms and stood more than 4 meters tall. Many mammoths likely got stuck in the mud, Manzanilla said. But he said that evidence at nearby places suggests early human hunters used spears to kill the mammoths. They also may have used traps in the water. Over 10,000 years ago, central Mexico had many groups, or herds, of mammoths. The bones they left behind led some people to create stories about giants. López Luán wrote about some of the stories in the publication Mexican Archaeology recently. In 1519, two local kings showed the Spaniard Hernán Cortés what was probably a mammoth leg bone. They told Cortés that the bone came from terrible, tall men. Bernal Díaz del Castillo, a soldier and writer at the time of Cortés, wrote about the incident. "We were sure there had been giants in this land," wrote Díaz del Castillo. I'm John Russell.
This week, in our National Parks journey, we explore a vast area with mountains, beaches, forests, and glaciers. The area's huge range in both rainfall and elevation make it one of the most diverse parks in America. Welcome to Olympic National Park. The park is located in the western state of Washington. It is on the Olympic Peninsula in the northwest part of the state. The park covers more than 400,000 hectares. It has several different ecosystems. Visitors will find temperate rainforests, glacier-covered mountains, and almost 120 kilometers of wild coastline.
The Olympic Peninsula has seen travelers from many countries throughout history, including Mexico, Spain, France, Russia, and England. Many travelers from these countries arrived in the late 1700s. They were searching for the Northwest Passage. The sea route connects the Northern Atlantic and Pacific Oceans by way of the Arctic Ocean. These explorers all claimed to discover different parts of what is now Olympic National Park. In 1792, English captain George Vancouver explored the peninsula in great detail by boat. He named many of the natural features in the area. Later, people began moving west across North America to search for gold. This era was known as the Gold Rush. Many people came to the western United States in search of gold. At the time, the Olympic Peninsula was not very developed and did not have roads. People had to travel by boat or horse to explore the peninsula.
Early settlers reached the Olympic Peninsula in the mid-1800s. At first, people built homes on the coast. This area was easier to access and had good land for farming. Life on the Olympic Peninsula was difficult, however. People lived far from large cities and resources. They cut trees to build cabins. They also hunted and fished for food. Later, people started making expeditions into the center of the peninsula. They explored its forests and mountains. These areas never became very populated, however. To protect the nature of the area, President Grover Cleveland declared the Olympic Peninsula's forests as the Olympic Forest Reserve in 1897. And in 1938, President Franklin Roosevelt signed the bill that established the Olympic National Park.
Eight Native American tribes are closely connected to the area. One tribe, the Macaw, has a long history of whaling. The U.S. bans whaling, but the Macaw tribe is permitted to continue practicing this tradition in small amounts. American courts also gave Native American tribes the right to continue their traditional fishing practices in the area. Protecting fish resources is important to the Native Americans living on the Olympic Peninsula. They work with the National Park Service to protect the area's natural resources.
Olympic National Park has meadows and lakes. It has glacier-fed rivers and mountain peaks that rise more than 2,300 meters. Each area of the park offers visitors something special. The Elwha Valley is in the central part of the park. It is the Olympic Peninsula's largest watershed. A watershed is an area of land that separates waters that flow to different rivers or seas. Long ago, the rivers in this area held the most salmon outside of Alaska. The area also was home to bears, eagles, cougars, and the Tlalum Native Americans. In the 1920s, a growing community of settlers built two hydroelectric dams to provide energy for the local economy. The dams created many problems for the river. They decreased the water in the rivers, which caused the fish population in the area to decrease. This affected the other animals that depended on fish for food. The community later decided to fix these problems. In 1992, Congress passed the Elwha River Ecosystem and Fisheries Restoration Act. Both dams have been removed, and the National Park Service is using fish hatcheries to increase the salmon population. Today, the Elwha River is the site of one of the largest ecosystem restoration projects in National Park Service history.
The Ho River is on the west side of the park. The river is formed from melted glacial ice on top of Mount Olympus. The river is 80 kilometers long. It empties into the Pacific Ocean. The area receives about 400 centimeters of rain each year. It is a temperate rainforest. Because of the amount of rain, many different types of plants grow in the Ho rainforest. From mosses and ferns to huge Sitka spruce trees, the Ho River Valley is protected from any logging or development. Hurricane Ridge is a mountain area in the northern part of the park. It is easy to enter and provides incredible views of the Olympic Mountains. The ridge has many hiking paths. In winter, people come here to ski. They also come here to take part in other fun winter activities like sledding and snowboarding. Hurricane Ridge usually has snow from December through the end of March. Visitors must be prepared for icy roads and severe weather.
The westernmost part of the park is Pacific coastline. Olympic National Park has many breathtaking beaches. Rialto Beach is known for its tall sea stacks. These formations are tall towers of rock standing in the sea. North of Rialto Beach is Hole in the Wall. It is a natural arch that has been carved by the powerful sea. Claylike Beach is known for its white sand. It also has three national wildlife refuges, which protect the area's bird and fish species. The coastline areas offer hiking and camping. They are some of the most popular places in the park.
I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.